Can I talk to Lula?
You are not gonna see him ever.
Mark Hill. I'd go the far end of the world for you, baby.
A man can't ask for more than that.
You move me, Sal. You really do.
You want me to shoot Sailor in the brains with a gun?
I didn't have much parental guidance.
Baby, you better run me back to the hotel. You got me hotter than Georgia asphalt. This whole world's wild at heart and weird on top.
Hello and welcome to The Complete Works, an in-depth look into the career and filmography of Nicolas Cage. My name is Mike Smith, and joining me on this journey into the depths of true cagedom is my friend, co-host, and fellow cageaholic,
Mike DiCruccio.
How are you doing today, Mike?
Good. I'm excited to talk about Nicolas Cage and one of my favorite directors.
Yeah, this is going to be
David Lynch.
This is going to be exciting. Yeah, so in the year 1990, Nicolas Cage starred in two movies, the first of which was Firebirds, which was...
Who could forget that classic?
I feel like we already have.
Yep.
But it was Cage's first real foray in action movies, and it was, by all accounts, a pretty major disappointment. The other movie, though, is almost the exact opposite. It is an oddball, erotic crime thriller with elements of both comedy and horror. Yep. David Lynch's Wild at Heart, which premiered at the Cannes Film Festival on May 25th, 1990, before opening in the U.S. in August of that year. The movie was incredibly divisive upon release. At the Cannes Film Festival premiere, it was met with both wild cheering and a chorus of boos.
I feel like that kind of describes Lynch's whole career.
Yeah, and it describes the Cannes Film Festival pretty well, because that happens a lot.
Yep, that's true.
But it does describe Lynch's career, you're right. But despite the chorus of boos, the film won the Palme d'Or at the Cannes Film Festival, which is the top prize.
Wow.
So that's pretty crazy. And it would prove to be a mild box office success. On the budget of $10 million, it made $14 million.
So count it, I guess.
Yeah, that's not bad.
Yeah.
It made its budget back, and, you know, a little bit more. It's funny, because $14 million is the exact same that Firebirds made.
So what was the budget of that film?
$22 million.
Oh, yeah, right, okay.
Yeah, Firebirds is a disappointment. this movie made the same amount of money, but had a much smaller budget. And I like to imagine that the exact same number of people saw this movie as Firebirds.
And Firebirds got up and walked into
Wild at Heart. Because they were so thrilled with Cage's performance in Firebirds.
That must have been it.
That they just went, well, oh, he's right here. Oh, man, this is a really good movie. Wild at Heart stars Cage as Sailor Ripley, opposite Laura Dern as Lula Pace Fortune. The IMDb plot synopsis reads, young lovers Sailor and Lula run from the variety of weirdos that Lula's mom has hired to kill Sailor.
That's, yep.
That was accurate.
That's it.
A very short plot synopsis. But now Lynch has openly acknowledged the divisive nature of this movie, and then again, Lynch knows a thing or two about making divisive movies.
Mm-hmm.
And he has said that, like, early test screenings of the movie did not go well at all. He said about 80 people walked out of the first test screening.
Wow.
And 100 people walked out of the second test screening.
That's kind of awesome.
Yeah, that's pretty wild. Wild at Heart. Yeah, it's pretty wild. At Heart. Wild at Heart was written and directed by David Lynch and based on the novel by Barry Gifford. The film was put together very quickly. Shortly after he had finished working on the pilot episode of Twin Peaks, Lynch was working on another film when he read Gifford's novel and decided he wanted to make a movie based on it. So he was already in production on this other movie that he was working on, and decided to switch gears and just do this. So that meant like everything was already underway for that other movie he was doing, and then he just switched what he was doing halfway through. So he like, this meant production was already underway. It was scheduled to start in just 2 months after he bought the rights. So he had to write the first draft of the screenplay in 1 week.
Wow.
And just rush through, like, casting and everything like that. It was in this time Lynch changed the ending of the book, in which, in the book, Sailor and Lula split up for good.
Okay.
Yeah, and his reasoning was saying that it honestly didn't seem real, considering the way they felt about each other. It had a certain coolness to it, but I couldn't see it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. The way that this movie progresses and the way things happen, it seems odd that they would split up, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like the way it kind of goes on, like, it might work in the book. I don't know if it does or not, but like the way Lynch directs this movie and the way he like kind of works with this couple and portrays this couple, it's a very fantastical movie anyway.
Yeah.
We're going to get to in a little bit.
Yes.
But it's a lot of it is like heightened fantasy, and so I feel like the ending is like the culmination of that in a lot of ways.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
But the two big influences Lynch brought to the screenplay were his love of The Wizard of Oz.
Never would have thought that. Which and, I'm sure we'll get into.
And his love of Elvis Presley. The film features multiple allusions to The Wizard of Oz, culminating in the ending in which Cage is a vision of Glinda the Good Witch. Which was something that Lynch added to the movie, basically. And then Cage's character, Sailor, is modeled after Elvis, and Cage sings again.
Yep.
We've been getting a lot more singing Cage than we bargained for when we started this podcast.
Yeah.
I'm happy about it. I'm pretty stoked.
I'm not mad.
Yeah. So Cage sings once again, and he sings two Elvis songs during the movie. And Sailor's snakeskin jacket, which is one of my favorite details in the movie, was Cage's idea.
My note was, I bet that's actually Cage's jacket. That's amazing.
Yeah, no, it was Nicolas Cage's idea. He called Lynch right before filming started and asked if he could wear one. And so Lynch actually just wrote it into the script, and it became a plot point. Which has one of my favorite lines in the movie, where very early on in the movie, like, Laura Dern shows up to pick Cage up from jail, and Cage is there. She's like, I brought your snakeskin jacket. It's like, oh my god, yeah, you brought my snakeskin jacket? You realize this jacket represents a symbol of my individuality and my belief in personal freedom?
Yeah. He's like, shouts it really fast. So out of place.
And then he says it again later in the movie.
Yeah, he says it a couple times. And it's funny. There's the point, later they go dancing at a metal club, because I guess that's what they do. And the guy, a person in the club starts dancing with Laura Dern, and in a very implausible fashion, Cage tells the band to stop playing, and like everyone stops and is like, oh, what's he gonna do?
Yeah.
And he's like talking, and a lot of his mannerisms and movements and stuff are very reminiscent. He's doing an Elvis impersonation, basically,
yeah.
And it's pretty bizarre, and I don't know. It fits into our narrative of what voice is Cage using, and that we've seen a lot of times.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I just wanted to bring that scene up.
Yes, I did want to talk about the scene a little bit. We will. And in addition to that, so Cage's character is based on Elvis. Dern's character, Lula, is modeled on Marilyn Monroe. So that kind of...
Oh, yeah.
Like, the way she talks and the way her character's portrayed. And, you know, I was, like, looking at that and like thinking about that, and it's interesting. I think it makes like both characters of that couple essentially like the ideal version of a man and a woman in the 1950s.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like the two most famous like men and women in the 50s were like Elvis and Marilyn Monroe. And so I think it's interesting that this movie like used those two as like a dichotomy for each other. They are very like different personas. Wild at Heart currently holds a 65% of Rotten Tomatoes, with many critics at the time kind of unimpressed, including Roger Ebert, who wrote that Lynch hides behind sophomore humor and the cop-out of parody. But time has been kind to the movie, and like all of Lynch's films, I don't think anybody can argue that it's a unique, singular vision. And it has gotten a lot of like reappraisal in recent years. Like, people are more on board with it now than they were back in 1990.
Okay, that's interesting. This has all of the touches of David Lynch in 1990, at least.
Yep. Yeah, so in addition to Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern, Wild at Heart also stars Diane Ladd, who scored the film's only Academy Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress, which, they like, just watching her performance, like, that's insane to me that she was nominated. Not because it's a bad performance, but because it's, like, totally insane.
Right.
Yes. Like it's an insane performance. Like she's totally going nuts in that movie, in this movie. Mm-hmm. It also stars Harry Dean Stanton, J.E. Freeman, W. Morgan Shepherd, Willem Dafoe, Crispin Glover, Best of Times Reunion, Grace Zabriskie, Isabella Rossellini, and a lot more. The film was written and directed by David Lynch, released during the height of Twin Peaks popularity. Yeah. His previous film was 1986's Blue Velvet. His next film would be the Twin Peaks follow-up, 1992's Twin Peaks Fire Walk With Me.
There you go.
So with all that said, Mike, so I know you're a big fan of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
And I've actually not seen Twin Peaks. I've been meaning to catch up on that for a long time. But I know you're a big fan, and so this movie was made at the same time as Twin Peaks. Like, did you feel like a connection to Twin Peaks at all in Wild at Heart?
Yes, this and what we're going to get into, Industrial Symphony Number 1, which we'll talk about later.
Right. Yeah, that one, I mean, I did more research on that one. That one seems like very intimately connected to Twin Peaks and Wild
Heart. I was going to say, that might as well be a companion piece to Twin Peaks. Like, however, this Wild at Heart, in a lot of supporting roles, it's I didn't realize that it was made at the same time as Twin Peaks. There's a lot of ensemble, you know, background character people that are from Twin Peaks, that
right.
which is really funny to see. Jack Nance, as always, as David Lynch collaborator in there, which was really cool. Is like, yeah, sure, why not be a crazy old man? but it features a lot of the motif. There's a lot going on with between Twin Peaks and Wild at Heart with the this weird like slow jazz soundtrack that there's a lot of you know Elvis music, metal music, because sure, why not?
Yeah, this has a very like eclectic soundtrack, I think.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
A lot of different kind of music going on in this movie.
But yeah, I don't know. It was kind. It's one of those like watching a train wreck, but not in a bad way. With that usually connotates, but like just sheer insanity on screen of a woman rubbing lipstick all over her face and like shouting at a mirror.
Yeah, that's the scene I was thinking of when I was like, "This was nominated for an Oscar." Like,
yeah,
because there's a scene where Diane Ladd is just like. Rubbing lipstick all over her face, shouting, and it goes on for a long time, and it cuts back to it every once in a while.
Right, that's the best. It moves on, and you're like, okay, I get that she's having a meltdown, and then we'll have another scene, and then we'll go back, and she's still melting down.
Yeah.
but like, it somehow Lynch makes that enthralling to watch. To watch. I don't know how he does it, but and he's got this. Very specific brand of ultraviolence that David Lynch has. Right. You know, the Tarantino ultraviolence is over the top and crazy and ridiculous and is kind of played for comedic effect. Whereas Lynch uses it in a real, I don't want to say realistic, but in a very grotesque, horrifying fashion.
Right.
And also, there's a lot of that in this too.
Yeah. And usually very suddenly too, I think. Like,
yes.
Like I remember the opening scene of this movie, it's like, it goes from like 0 to 10 very fast.
oh yeah.
yeah. A guy, like in the opening scene of this movie, some guy, comes up and tries to kill Cage, and Cage like just kills the shit out of him.
yeah. He just bashes his head against the marble floor. For a long time.
Yeah, it goes on for a while. And like, I don't think there's that much violence in this movie, but when there is, it's like, it shows up like very suddenly.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very jarring. And that phrase you used in the intro with contains elements of comedy and horror, I think sums up a lot of Lynch's work.
Right.
and very much so this film. But yeah, the boldness for Lynch to... That's the opening scene, is Sailor and Lula on a staircase leaving a party, it looks like.
Right.
Some guy tries to murder them, and then Sailor manslaughters him, which is... I love that they use that term.
Right, they call him a manslaughterer.
right. And he kind of wears, like, a badge of honor, which is weird. These are not very redeemable characters, even though it kind of puts them to be... It puts the love story of them as a triumph. Even though they are like pretty terrible humans.
yeah, true.
Which is, I enjoy that, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, at the same time, I feel like the movie gets you on their side very quickly. Both of them are doing a great job. I think Cage and Dern, like, they're both like giving really good performances, and they're such like a unique set of characters that like they're just really interesting to watch.
Right.
Even if you aren't on their side. But I think the movie kind of gets you on their side as it goes on, just because of what they go through over the course of the movie.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, definitely. I mean, they're not the villains by any means, but their actions are not.
Right. I think, yeah, comparatively speaking, I think that's what it is. There's a, you know, you have Diane Ladd, who is like the crazy mother who's hiring like bounty hunters to kill Cage and Dern. And so you have like a clear villain to root against. You have Cage and Dern to root for. And the villains of this movie are reprehensible also. Like they're,
oh yes, they are.
We should probably talk about Willem Dafoe, who is like mega creepy in this movie.
Oh, yeah, that he's like 98% gums when he smiles. I don't know. But it's interesting that there's this like seedy underworld that these characters live in, where the mother knows is like dating hitmen and using them to kill her daughter's boyfriend, and like that, there's like this whole weird underworld thing going on that presumably Sailor and Lula are trying to escape in some fashion, but
right,
very much a part of.
Sailor was the driver for Santos, right?
Right.
The gangster that is on the run for them now, like trying to kill them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's then was there the night Sailor's, I mean, Lula's father died or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, there's a very, very incestuous, ultra-violent undertone in this whole film. I mean, it's not even an undertone. It is the tone of the film. That's like what this whole movie's about. But I don't know. Yeah, it's good. And, Dern and Cage are phenomenal, and I want to say that's the magic of David Lynch. Laura Dern is great in a lot of stuff. Cage, not so much.
Come on, man.
In this era, he is actually really good. He's
great. Beautiful. Cage is awesome. We're doing a podcast dedicated to Nicolas Cage. You gotta get on the side.
I'm never gonna get on board, Mike. Never gonna happen.
You should have told me that before we started this
that's
podcast.
That's why it's fun, though. But what about you, Mike? What are your opinions?
I like this movie a lot. I thought it was really interesting. I was really engrossed by it very quickly. I'm a big David Lynch fan too. His work just kind of really engrosses me a lot of the time. But I hadn't seen Wild at Heart, and so obviously I'm a fake David Lynch fan. I don't know. Well, yeah, because I haven't seen Twin Peaks either, so it's definitely a.
Sorry.
But
in time.
Yeah, soon, very soon. I'm definitely before Twin Peaks season 3 starts.
You got like 10 years for that. And by 10, I mean, I think 2.
Maybe 10 months. Like,
yeah.
But yeah, so and I was a big fan of this movie. I think this might be my favorite movie that we reviewed for the Cage podcast. It's really engrossing. It's really intense. It's often very funny. And it's such a unique experience.
Yeah.
You know, like you watch it and it's like there's so many scenes that you don't even really know what to make of, but you want to watch them again so you can try to analyze.
Yeah. There's a scene like that, one of my favorite scenes in the movie, and I love how I guess now there's 2 that I think about it. What Lynch uses film, like subverts film technique in a weird way. We have Lula and Sailor driving, and Lula's listening to the radio, and it's like all these terrible newscasts, and she pulls over, she can't take it anymore, and Sailor finds the metal station somehow. And then, like, start dancing, and they jump out of the road, start dancing.
Yeah.
And it's like this beautiful crane shot in the golden hour, and it's like amazing. And they're just like throwing punches.
Yeah, and kick dancing. Like,
it's amazing. It's shot and framed in a way that's like supposed to be this beautiful romantic moment, and they're just like moshing on the side of the highway.
Yeah, I did like the. I did want to talk about that scene you mentioned before where Cage stops the rock show, because the way it happens is amazing. Where he just like, he does like the devil horns with his hands, like puts it up to the band, and that's it. Everybody just stops playing. Everybody stops playing. The entire like audience just like shuts up and like moves to the side.
Yep.
It's pretty amazing. And the guy makes fun of Cage's snakeskin jacket, and Cage is like, are you kidding me? This jacket is a symbol of my individuality and believe in personal freedom.
Yeah, that scene really highlights the fantastical elements of this film, which, as you've talked about, The Wizard of Oz is a through line
right.
for the whole story, their whole They always talk about the Wicked Witch, the, you know, Yellow Brick Road, clicking. Lula clicks her heels together, when, you know, and then literally Glinda shows up.
Right.
But even before all that stuff happens, we have. I didn't realize it at the moment. Right after that scene where Cage manslaughters and then is put into jail, it like kind of zooms out a little bit and he's in a crystal ball and like a hand waves over the crystal ball.
That happened a few times in the movie and I didn't catch it at first, but like as it went on, like I realized that was another Wizard of Oz reference.
Right. I didn't pick it up the first time or two it happened, but then when it happens, you know, 3 minutes into the movie or something.
Yeah.
Like, and I was like, oh wow, David Lynch just going for it. Like, sure. Cause then it comes back and it says like 22 months later or something like that.
Right.
So I thought it was just like a weird way to show a time jump. And then it's like, all right, sure, David Lynch, we could do that. But then as it goes on, it progresses into, you know, fits into the Wizard
right.
of
yeah.
Oz.
They allude to Wizard of Oz a lot. I mean, they reference the Yellow Brick Road. They reference like the Wicked Witch. And there's a part as after Willem Dafoe sexually assaults Laura Dern.
Yeah.
She like clicks her heels 3 times and tries to go home.
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
That's the her, and their red slippers as well. Right. You know, and then it does all culminate in the Glinda the Good Witch vision. And I feel I think it's an interesting like way, like it's parallel. Like she's trying to draw parallels to Wizard of Oz in an interesting way. And I feel like, you know, Wizard of Oz is obviously like a fantasy movie. And I feel like it's using the fantasy of Wizard of Oz to inform the fantasy of Wild at Heart in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's a really interesting, you know, Wizard of Oz is about trying to escape your situation, you want to leave your home, and you go on this epic fantasy, and it turns out it's all lies, so you go home, and home's pretty great. Which is kind of what the super short version of this film is. They want to get away from her mother, they want to be together, and, like, it's they think it's not good, and, you know, then Sailor gets his ass handed to him by a random gang for some reason. I don't know what that was.
Right.
And then it turns out, you know what? Home is pretty good. And they go back. It's weird.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was an interesting last scene, the way, like, he was just walking down the street and, like, the gang started, like, slowly kind of building up. And it was weird. I thought Cage's line was amazing, where he says, what does he say? Oh, yeah. No, Cage's line where, like, the gang is, like, closed in on him. And he, like, just lights up a cigarette and goes, "What do you faggots want?" And and they all just beat him up.
They jump him. And then he says, and then when he wakes up, he says, like, "I apologize for calling you homosexuals. You've shown me a great lesson in life." And then turns around and runs back to Lula. And it,
yeah.
And he's got that big prosthetic, like, broken nose on.
Yeah. Once again, Nicolas Cage, broken prosthetic nose.
Prosthetic nose.
Which actually, I was debating whether to do a joke at the beginning of this podcast, but now that I mentioned the prosthetic nose, I might as well bring it up. Yeah. This week I watched a movie featuring Nicolas Cage and a blonde woman, most of which takes place on a highway, and is mostly an excuse for several high-profile cameos to show up. And Nicolas Cage wears a prosthetic nose. But enough about Never on Tuesday.
Wow, it took a long time to get there, but I like it, man. Oh, boom goes the dynamite.
Boom goes the dynamite. Yes, that was the big joke there. I was like, I wasn't going to do it, but then you brought up the prosthetic nose. And I was like, I can't not do it now.
Yeah, sitting right there.
Yeah, this is also another in a string of movies where you watch Nicolas Cage grabbing boobs.
Yep, that's true.
Because yep. That was also in Birdie and the Boy in Blue, and I don't know why I've been writing that down, but it's just something.
Somebody's got to do it, Mike.
Somebody's got to. Well, because I remember in Birdie, it was a big part of his character was that his character loved boobs.
Right, that's true.
And then the Boy in Blue, I remember just that gratuitous boob shot where he grabs the boobs.
Yep.
Happened again here, and actually, like, I would say about 60% of this movie is either Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern having sex, or Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern having a deep conversation right after having sex.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. There's a lot of gratuitous nudity in this film, as I think a lot of David Lynch stuff.
Right. Yeah.
There's a lot of ultraviolence, a lot of gratuitous nudity.
Right. The Lynch package.
Yeah. And like, you'll probably feel really uncomfortable about it.
Yeah. And then there's just a bunch of weird scenes, like There's a scene where they're at the bar, Cage at the bar, and there's a guy there at the bar who's just like speaking in tongues.
Yes. Yeah.
And he sounds like Stitch from Lilo and Stitch. Like he's kind of
right. Or like, I was thinking Donald Duck, but that works too. Yeah, it's a that ties right into Twin Peaks. That's a thing which ties into Industrial Symphony Number 1.
Right.
With I wrote his name down. I forget. Wait. Right, well, Michael J. Anderson.
Right, well, we're going to talk about that soonish. Soon.
Yeah.
Soon, boy. Soon.
Basically, my note is I just want to watch Twin Peaks. Like, this made me just want to go back and rewatch Twin Peaks. Because it's so... It hits all the same notes, for network TV version of... but it still astounds me that that was able to happen. Just weird, surreal, horror stuff... I don't know.
Well, on network TV?
Yeah, on primetime and network TV.
Yeah, and that was a huge hit.
Right.
Like, people loved it. People were nuts for Twin Peaks.
they still are.
But yeah, and so this movie stars Isabella Rossellini as a Perdita Durango, who is kind of briefly in the movie. But I did want to mention that because Perdita Durango was the subject of her own movie in 2003, and the movie was called Perdita Durango. It starred Rosie Perez as the character. It has no relation to Wild at Heart. But it's like just based on the another one of the author's novels.
Oh, okay.
Rosie Perez plays Perdita Durango, and Javier Bardem's in that movie as well. So I thought that was of interest. Just wanted to bring that up. But what did you think of the supporting cast of this movie? I mean, Diane Ladd was nominated for Best Supporting Actress, but other than her and everybody else, like, I don't know, who stood out to you? Who was like of interest to you?
The cast of hitmen. They're all creepy and like that underworld part. I didn't write look at anyone's names, but the character who requests the silver dollars be brought to him, and he's like, he's kind of looks like who's in charge of dealing this contract, and he's got like this weird harem, and there's all these weird assassins I think hanging out with him, and like it's very just bizarre.
Yeah.
And that whole every sequence with him and that world. I want to keep watching it, but, like, I don't because it's creepy as hell. Yeah, I don't know. What about you, Mike?
Well, I mean, I mentioned Willem Dafoe before, but I think he's definitely the standout for me. Outside of Cage Dern and Diane Ladd. Like, I think he's, like, just such... I mean, he's a standout in a lot of movies, but he's, like, his very singular presence. And he's, you know, dialing up the creep factor very significantly in this movie.
Oh, yeah. He's on 11.
Yeah. This is, like, if you thought Norman Osborn was creepy in Spider-Man, this is, like... Next level.
This is a rapey Norman Osborn.
But I mean, I thought Harry Dean Stanton was a lot of fun to watch. Like his kind of just confused, his kind of confusion dealing with Diane Ladd whenever like they were talking.
Yeah,
it was pretty good. And you know, he is kidnapped later in the movie and presumably dies. You know, I think one of my favorite laughs in the movie is I think it's Santos who shows up talking to Diane Ladd. It's not Sandus. It's one of the police officers. He's like, oh, we found this in his room as to where he was. And it's a note. And she's like, can you read this? And then he like, opens up the note really slowly. And he's like, gone fishing with a friend.
Yeah, that was one of the other scenes that I love where Lynch kind of subverts stuff. And he does a lot in Twin Peaks, this exact thing, where he'll have a conversation going on between two characters that's advancing the plot. There's character, like there's stuff happening, but there's just a guy standing there that's never been in the movie, isn't doing anything but just standing there listening to the conversation.
Yeah.
He does it in Twin Peaks pretty often. He does it with a barbershop quartet in that film, which is bizarre. in that show. But that's one of my favorite things where, yeah, there's two people talking and a third guy standing there that we've never seen before. And he gets told to leave, and he's like, "Who? Why should me? Why do I have to leave?" And then he turns around and walks away. Like, it's very weird.
Yeah, and then there's like lines in this movie that are just really like oddball and weird, and kind of like reflect the dialect of the characters. But there would be like, you know, Cage was like talking about like this girl that he used to sleep with, and one of his lines is, "I had a boner with a capital O." And, like, that makes no sense.
That doesn't make any sense.
There's that, and, like, I think Dern has something where she compares something to like a duck on the June bug.
Yep.
Like, and you know, lines like that that reflect the dialect of the characters kind of creates the world that's you know, these characters are living in. And it's, you know, it's, I think they embody the characters really well. I think, yeah, we talked about a little bit about how good Cage and Dern are in this movie, but they really like epitomize their characters. I think
these characters are caricatures to some extent. I mean, they are, I guess.
Right. I mean, they're literally like Elvis and Marilyn Monroe.
Right. Right. Exactly. yet Cage and Dern, make them totally real and believable. I don't feel like I'm watching I mean, it is a parody, but I didn't feel like I'm watching this for parody's sake. I felt like this was a real story that they needed or wanted to tell, and they do a really good job.
Yeah.
With that.
Right. And yeah. And, one of the recurring themes in the movie, Nicolas Cage is a big Elvis fan. And during that scene in the club, during the scene where he stops everything, he, sings her an Elvis song. He sings her Love Me. But then afterwards she's like, why didn't you sing me Love Me Tender? And Cage's reason is like, well, I told you I want to sing Love Me Tender to my wife is the thing. And throughout the movie, and at the time when he says it, it seems like kind of a romantic thing, like, oh, you're going to hear Love Me Tender eventually,
right,
kind of thing. But then as the movie goes on, like, it becomes a running thing where, like, why won't you sing me Love Me Tender kind of thing. And so the movie finally, like, when they finally get back together at the end, it's this big dramatic moment, big emotional moment, and then he breaks into Love Me Tender as the credits roll. And I thought it was I really liked it. Like, that heightened reality of the scene really captures that very well, I think.
Yeah, that's a very interesting moment where after Glinda tells him that Lula forgives you, he gets up and he runs across a bunch of hoods of the cars and, like, stuck it, and like pulls her up out of their convertible onto the hood, and then he sings Love Me Tender as the credits roll.
I totally forgot that he was running on the hoods of the cars. That was the best. That was the best.
It's very weird. but like fits them very well. I don't know. And Chris, can we talk about Crispin Glover, who's in this for maybe a minute?
Right. Yeah, no, he has, like, one scene. So a lot of times after they have sex, Dern will have, like, a flashback sequence where she'll, like, explain something that happened to a member of her family, right? So, like, there's a scene where she talks about how her uncle raped her when she was 13. There's a scene she talks about how her father died. And then there's this scene where she talks about her cousin, Del. And Del is played by Crispin Glover. And, like, I don't really even know what to make of this scene.
I don't know. This film, it has that weird... kind of that device where somebody will say something in a scene and be like, the, you know, whatever, and then they'll trigger the flashback. But it kind of feels like those old, like, noir things where, like, they would stop the scene and turn to the camera and explain what, like, memory they have or something like that. Cause it pauses the current scene. We have the flashback. And then we come back to the current scene in that exact moment, and they keep going in the conversation, and it's very jarring to the stuff, especially the stuff they cut back to is horrific, like Laura Dern's character being raped or her father being burned alive, and like a lot of bizarre shit in like a very mundane conversation that they're having normally.
Right. Yeah.
But yeah, the Crispin Glover thing was just like. Crispin Glover doing Crispin Glover. I don't.
It was very weird, and he's only in like maybe 3 minutes. Like, it's a 3 minute scene. He plays a character named Del, and he loves Christmas and he wants it to be year round, and he gets very upset that it's not year round.
Yeah, because it protects him from the aliens.
Yeah, and there's this whole thing, and she like mentions that his mom found like cockroaches in Del's underwear.
Yeah,
that's like part of it, and then Del just disappears, and then he's never heard from him again.
Yeah, and that's it. Thanks, Crispin Glover.
Thanks for coming by. Thanks for stopping by. No, it's a very weird scene. I liked it. I think this movie, your enjoyment of this movie may depend on your tolerance for weirdness.
Right. That's true. This film does, but with those flashbacks and stuff, does a really good job of building this grotesque, horrific world for these characters.
Yeah.
Where this kind of shit just happens. And like Laura Dern's laughing about it. Like, oh yeah. LOL, he puts cockroaches in his underwear. Weird shit. I don't know. So that's what I wanted to bring up.
Good. All right. Well, Yeah, I guess I feel like that about wraps up for Wild at Heart. I mean, is there anything else you want to talk about this movie specifically?
I think this is an interesting move for Nicolas Cage, who we've talked about, you know, the first couple or the movies prior to this, he's kind of been ramping up towards, you know, being a leading man. He's an action movie, even though they weren't very successful, but. And then he takes this time to make Vampire's Kiss, Tempo de Uccidere.
Right.
He makes Firebirds, and then makes a David Lynch movie.
Right.
So he's kind of, it's interesting what his career path is at this moment, because right now he's kind of, you know, the next couple movies, well, maybe after the next couple movies, he becomes the legend of, you know, the 90s.
Right, Kate. Yeah. In a few years, he's going to win the Oscar for Leaving Las Vegas, and then he's going right. to star in a bunch of, like, crazy action movies like The Rock and Con Air and Face Off.
Yeah, and all that stuff he's known for. So it's interesting to see him kind of doing an art house movie. It's not an art house movie, but like a David Lynch movie. I don't know.
Right. And, I mean, he would do more of those as his career would go on as well. But, you know, definitely, I feel like... his career was ramping up. He was like being leading man for a while, and now he's still in lead roles for these past two movies, Firebirds and Wild at Heart. And I feel like from this point forward, it's almost all leading roles for Cage,
right?
With like some exceptions, like I know like Kick-Ass is a supporting role,
right?
And you know there are other ones like that, but like from this point forward, it's pretty much all leading man Cage going on,
right?
But at the same time, he's like using that status, that leading man status, to try to. To like still do interesting projects, like
right, yeah, that's what I mean. He's like, not just playing it safe.
Yeah, like Vampire's Kiss was like a crazy, bizarre movie, and Tempo de Uccidere, maybe not the best movie, but it's an interesting project. Like it's definitely interesting that Cage did that.
That's what, yeah, it's a bold choice for him to make.
Yeah. anyway, it sounds like we're both big fans of Wild at Heart. But in addition to Wild at Heart, David Lynch also directed a short musical film featuring Nicolas Cage and Laura Dern in 1990 called Industrial Symphony No. 1, The Dream of the Broken Hearted. So now the complete works is mostly focused on Cage's feature film work, but this seemed like it was kind of interest because it's, I think, kind of a companion piece to Wild at Heart. Yeah. You know, it was made around the same time. It features Cage and Dern. Now, Cage and Dern are only featured in the opening phone conversation.
Right. So maybe 30 seconds.
Yeah, in which Cage, credited as the heartbreaker, breaks up with Dern, credited as heartbroken woman. Right. And I figured they would be in more of the short film.
You thought there was a story?
I thought there was more to their characters in this in this production. So that's on me. Although I'm not sad that we watched it, because it's interesting, at least.
Yeah.
So the characters they're playing, I think, show a resemblance to Sidler and Lula. And in a way, I was thinking about it, and this is kind of like an alternate ending to Wild at Heart, which would more closely resemble the ending of the novel.
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
You know, this is a... Because Cage breaks up with Dern, and then the entire play, as best as I could put it together, it's like the headspace of Dern's character processing the breakup.
Yeah, that's what I would assume.
Yeah. But after their conversation, that opening phone conversation, the rest of the short is a 40-minute, experimental, incredibly abstract stage production featuring Julie Cruise and Michael J. Anderson. And Cruise is known to Lynch fans for performing the theme song to Twin Peaks.
Yes.
And the songs in this play are featured on Cruise's albums. One song, actually, Rockin' Back Inside My Heart, was featured on Twin Peaks in the episode where Laura Palmer's killer is revealed, right?
Yeah. So as soon as we have this phone conversation, and then it moves to the stage production, Julie Cruise stepped out, and I was like, that's the Twin Peaks person, I think. And then she starts singing, and I was like, oh, yeah, no, that's the Twin Peaks person. this features very much the same musical styling that Twin Peaks has. It has a lot of, I mean, it's called Industrial Symphony, so there's a lot of industrial ambient noise, sirens, at one point, just a log being sawed.
Right. And the one song in that log is Michael J. Anderson, who is recognizable to Twin Peaks fans as well.
Yes.
Right, he played the man from another place.
Yes, who's the person who speaks backwards with the weird voice, just like...
the dwarf.
just like the guy in Wild at Heart.
Right.
Speaks with the weird voice. He doesn't talk backwards in Wild at Heart, but... and it's very interesting because Twin Peaks takes place in a town founded by its sawmill. So, like, it's very much the same, I don't even know, same theme? I don't know. Yeah. That's not the right word. Motif, I guess we could say.
Sure.
But this very odd, melodramatic, avant-garde thing you can't really follow. There's kind of, there's a semblance of a plot.
Right. Like, there's, I couldn't really follow it. I mean, I kind of got, like, there were bits of it where I was like, I think I got like, a gist of what's going on. But, like,
right.
Most of the time, I had no idea what was happening. The music in this piece was composed by David Lynch and Angelo Badalamenti, who composed the score for most of Lynch's movies, including Wild at Heart and also Twin Peaks.
There you go.
As a Twin Peaks fan, which you are, was this? Did you think Industrial Symphony was an interesting companion piece to Twin Peaks and also Wild at Heart? You know?
Yeah. I wonder what it would be. I'm curious to hear what you have to say as someone who hasn't watched Twin Peaks, because for me, I could say it's a companion piece. They're not related directly, but they follow similar things. They use similar devices and stuff. So I was like, oh yeah, this is cool. Like it's, reminds me of Twin Peaks and that's good. but so for you, who doesn't have that connection? Did it feel like it was lacking anything? Was it just a weird experience you had?
It was definitely a weird experience.
Yeah.
No, I don't have the connection to Twin Peaks. Although I'm like familiar with Twin Peaks. Like I know a decent amount about Twin Peaks just through like pop culture osmosis.
Right.
Right. Like I know about Laura Palmer and I know I recognize Michael J. Anderson when he showed up.
And he's even in a red suit in this. Like yeah, exactly. He is in Twin Peaks.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's that, but I was looking at this as through the lens of trying to connect this back to Wild at Heart. And so, like I said, the characters bear a resemblance to the characters in Wild at Heart. And this is kind of like if Wild at Heart had ended in a more downer ending, I feel like this could be like the headspace of Laura Dern's character.
Yeah. And this putting it that way definitely seems the way Lula would process this. Like I can see her character having this weird wars. Like at one point there's like an air raid siren and like, flashing lights and there's like bombs going off.
Yeah. It's also a recurring motif of fire that occurs in both Wild at Heart and Industrial Symphony Number 1.
Yes. And Twin Peaks.
And Twin Peaks, I'm sure.
Movies Fire Walk With Me.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. There's another scene that's actually, so I didn't, when I watched Wild at Heart, I didn't put the Marilyn Monroe connection together when I first watched it.
Yes.
But then when I watched Industrial Symphony Number 1, like there's a scene, there's a long sequence where Julie Cruise is dressed up as Marilyn Monroe singing out of the trunk of a car. And I recognized that right away. And so when I went back and like was doing research for this podcast and like looking at Wild at Heart stuff, I saw that David Lynch was trying to model Dern's character after Marilyn Monroe. And I was like, oh, wow. So this actually could be like Dern's character from Wild at Heart. Like it's both are kind of modeled on Marilyn Monroe in different ways.
Yeah. It's interesting that, the timeline for these three things are kind of all at the same time. From what I could find, apparently Industrial Symphony Number 1 was originally performed at some, I didn't write it down, New York art festival thing, in November 1989.
Yeah.
Was then filmed and released in 1990. I think Twin Peaks premiered in April, and then when did you say? And then August is when
Wild at Heart came out. Yeah.
So these kind of three things are all one weird project altogether.
Yeah, yeah. It's a really interesting time in Lynch's career where he's making projects that dealt with a lot of similar themes, but like did so in like interesting ways and like different kind of ways.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really really cool. And so I mean, what did you think overall of the experience of watching Industrial Symphony Number 1? Like, what was your reaction to watching certain scenes in this thing? Because I had like a very visceral reaction to certain stuff.
Yeah, it's like the skinned deer on stilts.
Yeah, I that freaked me the fuck out.
Yeah.
the way it happens, like Julie Cruise is like floating in the air.
Right. There's a lot of wire work happening,
and she's been singing like this pretty like quiet song for like 5 minutes, like a long time. And I at that point I was like, I'm not as into this anymore. Like I was kind of like falling out of it.
Yeah.
And then out of nowhere, she just suddenly falls.
Yeah. Yep.
And it looks like she actually falls. Like she looks like she fell off the wires or something.
Yeah.
And there's this loud screeching sound. And then like
strobe lights.
Strobe lights. And then there's a group of like guys who like run over to her and like put her on a table and start like kind of making motions around her. And then suddenly she's this like gigantic red fire demon.
But the credit is skinned deer on stilts.
Skinned deer on stilts, yeah.
And it's like a person in a latex suit that looks like a skinned deer.
Yeah, but it, I was horrified. I I did not see that coming at all. I had a bad reaction to that.
Yeah. This is also one of those things that is a, you know, have open in the tab and then listening to it and then also watching it. But that moment I had it, I was on another tab and I just hear a loud screech and a thud and I went back to it and was like, what the fuck? Then had to go rewind the video.
Yeah.
Cause luckily this is on YouTube if anyone wants to watch it.
Yes. This is this Industrial Symphony No. 1 is available on YouTube. It has Spanish subtitles, but, you know, it is available.
Yeah. Learn some Spanish while you're at it, I guess.
Right. Now we can speak fluent Spanish.
Interesante. You're welcome. Yeah, that's for you, man.
That's an inside joke, podcast listeners.
You're welcome. Nothing better than an inside joke on a public thing. But yeah, that moment, that's the quintessential Lynch. It's the ultraviolence in the most unexpected moment.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's what I was thinking about when I was saying like it just happens very suddenly. And also another horrifying imagery that this thing placed upon me. There's a scene towards the end where there's a bunch of babies like hanging from strings.
That's what I was gonna say. But that was the like air raid moment,
right? There's like probably like 50 babies like that are just hanging from strings in the middle of the air, and I was like horrified. I was,
yeah,
you know, it's not something I was expecting to see, and you know, it's pretty rough. It was pretty intense.
Yeah, there's an interesting. It's an interesting way they do that because it's a long shot or wide shot or whatever. Where the air raid sirens, you know, flashing lights, pyrotechnics. Sounds like airplanes and stuff. And then they slowly lower these things down on wires. And it from in the long shot, it looks like it could be like paratroopers or like, you know, people, air, you know, whatever, dropping troops in, and then they zoom in and get close-ups of like, nope, those are babies. It's like very unsettling.
Yeah, and also one of the things about this is that it's pretty much lit almost entirely by spotlights. Like, there's not like an actual like there's no point where the lights come up and you see like you can see more clearly. You see the spotlights, and so it's very hard to see a lot of things that happen in this production. I think it's very much intentional. Yeah. Like it's like everything else is like shrouded in darkness except for what's happening in the spotlight.
Yeah, and they have an interesting thing where they do where the person is on stage holding the spotlight. Like you could see the stage, like the stage hand is kind of part of the production,
right?
Like they're walking around the person with holding the spotlight on them. I don't know. Just David Lynch doing weird David Lynch things.
Yeah, and then I think the standout scene for me, the one that there's a scene in the middle of it where Michael J. Anderson comes back out with a guy playing the oboe, I want to say.
Sure.
Sure. somebody playing an instrument and this woman dancing seductively next to him. And he says, "This is the dream of the brokenhearted." And then he recites the entire conversation that Cage and Dern had in the beginning of the production, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's a, like, because it's a stage play, I wonder if the conversation had been recorded after the production had been filmed. I wonder if that was like an afterthought thing they thought.
That's possible, yeah.
You know, because it seems really out of place that he would come out and have recite that conversation by himself. I mean, I wouldn't put it past Lynch to do it, but
right. But I think that's I don't know. I feel like it made sense. Like I feel like it kind of put the entire play into perspective, right? Because you had that first conversation with Cage and Dern, and they're like you understand that they just broke up, and then it gets into this long, you know, experimental music thing,
right?
And like if you listen to the lyrics of the songs, you can kind of put together that it's kind of based on the fallout of that breakup.
Yeah.
But you know, I feel like having him come out and say and recite the entire thing kind of like pushes that even further. Like, this is like the dream self of the brokenhearted, is what the dream of the brokenhearted. Although Julie Cruz's character is called the dream self of the heartbroken woman is what her official credit is.
Right. Yeah. So it definitely does serve as a, not bookend. It's almost a bookend. That's towards the end of the film or the end of the piece. It does reinforce, what's going on. Cause then I think it's after that the creepy hanging babies part. And,
the hanging babies was definitely towards the end.
I feel like up until that point when Michael J. Anderson reads it, it's kind of just weird. It's not much. I mean, it's weird throughout, but it's not. Yeah. It's not. After that point, things kind of get combative, you know, with the ambient noise and all that stuff. It gets much more jarring, I guess. So we get to have that breakup twice. I don't know, her reliving it or something, we could say.
Right.
Because why not?
Right. Because it kind of brings you through their entire relationship. Like, it starts off and she's singing about how she's in love with them or something, right? I don't remember exactly, but she's singing about how she's in love with them, and as it goes on and it gets into the breakup and everything gets really fucking weird really fast. And
yep.
I was very unsettled by Industrial Symphony number one, if you couldn't tell.
Yeah.
I don't know. Is there anything else you want to talk about, Industrial Symphony, Mike?
No, I think we've kind of talked about.
We've kind of got a pretty good handle on it.
Yeah, we've conveyed how fucking weird it is.
Yeah,
so.
But definitely, and yeah, that's on YouTube, so it's worth checking out. I think, especially if you're a fan of David Lynch, like you know, definitely interesting. And it's, you know, I've been slacking on Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. I've been meaning to watch it for years.
Might be the time, Mike.
This might be, like, now that I've watched Wild at Heart and Industrial Symphony number one, I feel like I'm just in that Lynch mode. Like, so I
kind of want to rewatch it. I might do it.
Yeah, so probably do that soon, hopefully. Yeah. It's going to be I guess it's going to be it for us. So, Mike, where can we find you online this week?
You can find me at twitter.com/mdfilmblog. I'm on Letterboxd now because of Mike at, I believe, also mdfilmblog.
Yeah, have you used that at all since...
Since that day? No, I have not.
All right. Good.
Forgot about it.
Good.
And if you like Dungeons & Dragons, my friends and I stream our games at twitch.tv/geonerd79.
And you can find me online at twitter.com/msmithfilmblog. You can find me on Letterboxd at MikeSmithFilm. And you can find all of our podcasts at filmbook.com. I podcast about Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and Agent Carter and Gotham and a bunch of other stupid stuff.
Real professional, Mike.
Well, Gotham has gotten so bad, man. I mean, it was always not great. But I was like, when the season first started, like, I had hope, and there was like some solid episodes in there. But like, the last few episodes have just been dire, man. A couple of Mr. Freeze episodes, and they were not good. I would have rather watched Batman and Robin's Mr. Freeze.
So your reception to them were pretty cold.
I definitely had a chilly reception to them. And you can find our other podcasts at filmbook.com as well, FilmBookCast. Thank you for listening to The Complete Works. I'm Mike Smith. That's Mike the Capriccio. If you're listening to this review of your podcast on iTunes, please subscribe to the podcast, rate it, take a moment to give us a review. Any and all feedback, compliments, topic discussions, even hate mail can be sent directly to podcast@filmbook.com. If you want to watch Industrial Symphony number one and get back to us with your weird thoughts, you know, definitely do that.
I hope so. Yeah, I want to know what people think.
Yeah. So please list the podcast you're about inside of your email, because there's so many different ones hard to keep track. We would love to hear from you. Join us in 2 weeks, where we'll be discussing Nicolas Cage reuniting with his Fast Times at Ridgemont High co-star Judge Reinhold.
Whoa.
In the erotic thriller Zandali. There's one thing that shrinks a boner faster. It's a erotic thriller starring Judge Reinhold.
I don't know, but the best four words ever are Nicolas Cage erotic thriller.
True. So we'll see what happens. And you can check out this week's film bookcast, where it'll be Smith v. DiCriccio, Dawn of Opinions.
Whoa.
As we review that new DC movie everybody's talking about, Batman v. Superman, Dawn of Justice.
There it is.
So I'm pretty, you know, that should be interesting. You know, we'll see what
happens. Excited is a word?
It's definitely,
you can use?
Definitely a word.
Yeah.
There's that. So that'll be interesting. I think, reviews of that will be coming out probably tonight. Okay. And that'll be really interesting. Because, I'm not a fan of Man of Steel. And I don't know, did you see Man of Steel, Mike?
I think.
You think?
So take that as my answer.
Yeah. I mean, if you can see Man of Steel before Batman v Superman, that might be good. Just to
that'll probably help.
But if not, not a big deal. I don't really care.
Oh, it's going to be such a good podcast.
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting. All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. We are out.